Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And we begin by what is, by my possibly dodgy counting, the US Secretary of State's 8th visit this year to the Middle East. He's certainly made a lot of visits anyway. Sometimes they've taken place with Antony Blinken borne aloft by a fair bit of positive spin work, briefings that there's tangible process towards a ceasefire in Gaza, a ceasefire which has nonetheless continued to fail to materialise. Today, though, Mr. Blinken touched down in Tel Aviv to a much more downbeat accompaniment. There's little talk of an end to the fighting, a release of the hostages, an end to the misery for the Gazans trapped, fearful and hungry. So what can he hope to achieve? The picture has changed, after all, now that the Hamas leader, Yahya Sinwar, has been killed by the Israelis. We'll hear in a moment from our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman, who's travelling with the Secretary of State. But first, a sense of what is happening in and around Gaza from our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. We, along with other independent journalists, aren't allowed into Gaza to report. So this is what Jeremy managed to gather from Israel. His report begins with the news on Monday that at least 10 people had been killed by Israeli artillery fire, which hit a camp for displaced people at a school in the Jabalia refugee camp, a densely populated urban area to the north of Gaza City.
Palestinian first responders went to collect bodies in a lull in Israel's offensive in Jabalia and the rest of northern Gaza. The UN says Gaza's nightmare is intensifying. A worsening humanitarian crisis amid what it calls relentless Israeli strikes. This was filmed by a nurse called Nabila in the moments after an Israeli strike on a UN school in Jabalia used as a shelter by civilians. Close to panic, she tries to tell this woman to be calm, saying, "I have nothing to stop the bleeding." She turns back to help the other casualties. She is the only medic there. Children are dead. A woman's leg has been blown off. And then she runs to get her medical bag. A child says, "Please help. My sister is dying." Nabila hasn't got much, a few basic wound dressings. One of the women says, "My children are gone, look at them." Back down the stairs, past dead children, and then she screams when she sees the dead body of an elderly man she recognises. Northern Gaza, just after an airstrike, from a vantage point a few miles away in Israel. It's a public holiday here. This is a popular place to observe the war. Israelis believe the killing and hostage taking by Hamas and the way Palestinians voted for them makes the war in Gaza and the others that followed necessary and just.
If they would return the hostages, then I would have what to feel for them. In the meantime, there's nothing I can feel for them. They've started this, they entered Israel, they attacked us, and all this is the results of their initial actions.
A short drive away, close to the Gaza border, it was a family day out for Israelis who believe the war has given them the chance to recreate a very different Gaza. They want to restore Jewish settlements inside the Gaza Strip that the Israeli government removed in 2005. These people know what they want when eventually there's a ceasefire in Gaza. The Israeli government has only really said what it doesn't want. It doesn't want any kind of governance that looks like progress towards a Palestinian state. Now, that is a problem for its Western allies, the Americans, the British, and others, because they believe a Palestinian state alongside Israel is the only way to stabilize the region and not have perpetual war. Anita Toker brought her family up on a farming settlement in the Gaza Strip. For her, leaving was a gross injustice. I played her a report I did about her departure 19 years ago.
This is an integral part of the state of Israel.
Since that day in 2005, they've dreamt about a return, and now they see Palestinians forced out of large areas of Gaza and are pushing to replace them.
I think we have an opportunity to build much more than we had before. I think we should build cities in some of the places. We should bring many, many more of Israel's population into the Gaza Strip. I think those people in the Gaza Strip, and there are a lot, that want to leave. Why is Egypt and Israel not allowing them to leave and go to Europe?
The bomb shelters where Israelis fled from Hamas have been made into memorials to the dead and to the hostages. This is where many were cornered and killed. The war is changing the Middle East in ways no one fully understands yet, and it's widening and escalating.
Jeremy Bowen reporting, well, as I said, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Israel. Today he's already held a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Travelling with Mr. Blinken is our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman. Tom, I talked about the sort of the downbeat mood music ahead of Mr. Blinken's arrival. What's he there for?
Well, I mean, I think that's the fundamental question. And we're discovering, I think, that the parameters of this have sort of shifted almost as we were in the air and then landing in Tel Aviv, because the Americans kind of rushed this trip together in the hours following Israel's killing of Yahya Sinwar last week. And they felt really that there was a sort of strong moment here for a diplomatic opening to try and get talks revived to re-establish the ceasefire and hostage release process between Israel and Hamas, which had really been stalled for many, many weeks. Now, the Americans had blamed Hamas and Sinwar himself before he was killed for, they said, just simply walking away from the discussions. He was unobtainable for many weeks. In fact, there were even questions people were asking about whether he might have died because he hadn't been engaging with the process at all. So the Americans felt that with what they saw as an obstacle eliminated, that they could get this process up and running. I mean, the problem with that analysis is it sort of downplays the role that Benjamin Netanyahu had in also throwing obstacles in front of this at various points. And I think the problem the Americans have got now is that they've sort of rushed into this thinking they can get it reopened, and they've got two big problems. One is that, you know, Hamas haven't yet appointed a clear decision maker, certainly not someone that was in the position that Sinwar was in. There's this sort of five-person council, but no new leader elected when they discussed. When they do come up with that person, they might even keep the identity secret for their security reasons. And then you have Mr. Netanyahu, who is making no mention at all of diplomacy, instead wanting to, it seems, intensify the Israeli offensive in northern Gaza. And so I think in the sort of vacuum, the Americans are coming and saying they're going to talk about other things, including a post-war plan for Gaza. But I think they realize trying to get this process back up and running is pretty ambitious.
Mm. And I guess the other thing that you might expect Mr. Blinken to talk about is the contents of that letter that he wrote at the beginning of last week,
yeah,
which got leaked, him and the Defence Secretary Lloyd Austin. Very, very strongly worded letter to Israel saying you've got to improve aid distribution into Gaza. And I mean, this in the context, a few days after that letter was sent, I did an interview here on NewsHour with an Israeli minister who said to me on air, absolutely, we do have a blockade in northern Gaza, yeah, and it's perfectly allowable under international law. Any suggestion from Mr. Blinken or those who he's travelling with that you're speaking to that they are expecting to make progress on that?
Well, they're certainly going to raise it, and they've confirmed that to me. Mr. Blinken is still in a meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu in his office in Jerusalem now as we speak. They've been talking for over 2 hours, and it's ongoing. And that will be a subject of discussion. You know, that letter didn't mince its words. It wasn't supposed to become public, but it did. And so the Americans have, you know, confirmed that they are going to hold the Israelis to this, they say. And that was to give them 30 days, basically, they said, to surge aid into the north of Gaza, or there is the threat there of the potential for cutting some military assistance if they don't. And remember, the conditions in northern Gaza are, you know, absolutely appalling for the civilians there. You have aid groups warning that the Israeli military siege risks starving civilians to death. I mean, the Israelis, for their part, say this is all about routing Hamas, who are resurgent in the north of Gaza. But the reality remains the Americans are deeply unhappy with it. But the fact is, I think the track record for American diplomacy and sort of being able to really apply the pressure to make a very significant difference is patchy at best. Mm-hmm. And I don't think at the moment Prime Minister Netanyahu is in a sort of in a particular mindset where he feels it necessary to give everything to the Americans, give everything they want, largely because there's a US presidential election in 2 weeks. He knows they don't have much political space or political capital to work with at the moment.
Tom, I want to also ask you briefly, if I may, about Lebanon, because obviously Israel is fighting on more than one front, continuing to pound targets inside Lebanon as well. Health officials in Beirut have said today that an airstrike near a big hospital in the capital has killed at least 13 people. And on a Monday, another hospital in Beirut was picked out by the chief spokesman for the Israel Defense Forces, Admiral Daniel Hagari. In a video statement he released, he showed a 3D graphic rendition of Al-Sahel Hospital, under which he said there was a huge bunker constructed by Hezbollah.
Hezbollah built this bunker directly underneath this hospital. There are hundreds of millions of dollars in cash and gold inside the bunker right now. The Israeli Air Force is monitoring the compound, as you can see. However, we will not strike the hospital itself.
That was Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari speaking late last night in Israel. Tom, is there any sense that Antony Blinken is going to be trying to talk to the Israelis about trying to somehow wind down the conflict in Lebanon?
They are, or they say they are, raising that too. It's one of the points of discussion. I mean, on the attacks in densely populated parts of Beirut, and, you know, we had over the last few days as well, the Israeli bombardment of bank branches that they say were financing Hezbollah. But again, you know, some of these in residential buildings that were hit, some with evacuation warnings. But the Americans don't like this, but I think, you know, what they tend to do when you kind of press them on this is to stall on the specifics, but say they don't like the principle of the Americans hitting densely populated parts of Beirut.
And
they
the Israelis, yeah.
I think, felt, yeah, they, sorry, the Israelis rather, and they felt they had got the Israelis to sort of rein this in, and there were fewer airstrikes over a period of days, but they've clearly ramped it up again.
Okay, Tom, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us. That's our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman. Coming up on the programme, we'll be taking you back to more than 3 billion years ago and asking you to picture yourself standing on an island close to what would now be South Africa.
So as you're standing there, right, you would see this flash of light approaching you, and next you'd be hit by a big pressure wave from the impact itself. Then you would feel an enormous earthquake triggered by the impact. And at the same time, you know, the skies would start to darken and to heat up. And then probably what's going to actually kill you is the tsunami wave.
We'll explain what just hit you, but also why it's not necessarily all bad news. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Our main headline this hour: Lebanese officials say that an Israeli airstrike near the country's biggest hospital has killed at least 13 people and injured more than 50. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. We're exactly 2 weeks out from the US presidential election. In fact, millions have already filled in their ballot papers, with many states offering the chance to vote early. And according to the opinion polls, the overwhelming favourite is the comment that the polls seem very, very close, at least in terms of the headline figures for both candidates. So what can we pick apart from all the great torrent of information that's being generated by all these surveys? Kathy Frankovic is consultant with YouGov America. It's one of the big public opinion and data companies. She's also the former director of surveys at CBS News. Kathy, thank you very much for joining us. What are you reading into these latest opinion polls, other than it is tight?
Well, thank you for saying that right at the beginning, because that is exactly what it is. We see some slight movement, or you can find some slight movement. Basically, many people average polls, so when one new poll comes, things change, and you really shouldn't be taking whatever change that one poll has made in the average all that seriously, because another poll will come and we will see what happens. I think it's very important to watch the candidates, where they go, whom they're speaking to, what they're trying to say, and what kind of arguments they're making. And where they're going is mostly seven swing states. We think that right now, Kamala Harris can win 226 of the 270 electoral college votes required. We think that Donald Trump will easily have 219. There are 93 votes up for grabs. They are in places like Pennsylvania, like Michigan and Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina, Nevada, and Arizona.
And in those seven battleground states, as they're called, it's looking pretty tight in each of those states as well, isn't it?
In every single one. And it's also a case where poll averages may change because of the inclusion of one single survey, and then it may very well change again. So I think we just have to be very patient. We have to not jump to conclusions and just deal with the fact that this is a very close race.
And in your estimation, are there such things still as swing voters, independent voters? I mean, or is it more a case of just, you know, can people be enthused to go out and vote?
Well, there are two things here. One, trying to convince people, and there really aren't a lot of people who don't know who they're voting for or won't tell you who they're voting for. And second, it is to get people out. In public opinion polls, if you ask voters who state a commitment to Harris, to former President Trump, whether their minds could change, very few say they could. This is a baked-in electorate. And so getting them to the polls, it's what's very important.
Right. I mean, is there anything 2 weeks out? And it all sounds like it is pretty unpredictable. Do you think that there is anything, you know, are we just sort of buckling up and waiting now? Or do you think there is still the possibility that some outside event could intervene, could swing this?
Well, we've lived through several two-week periods where a lot changed. A president withdraws from the race. A new person is more or less anointed by the party. So things can change. Events can happen. I think the question is whether or not those events are going to be formidable enough to make a difference here. Yeah. What really matters is getting voters to the polls who are already committed, aiming to try and change the minds of the few people who might be available. For example, Kamala Harris is looking at potentially disaffected Republicans who might be dissuaded from voting for Trump. Trump is trying to make inroads with minority communities, particularly with minority men.
Okay. Kathy, we'll be glued to the opinion polls, as I'm sure you will be all the way up to the vote in 2 weeks. Now, new research into a huge meteorite that hit the Earth about 3 billion years ago says it caused the biggest tsunami in the history of the planet, at least the biggest one we know about. The lead author on the study is Nadia Drabon, assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University.
The meteorite was enormous. So the meteorite was between 40 and 60 kilometers in diameter. So that means that the S2 meteorite was 50 to 200 times bigger than the one that killed the dinosaurs. The effects of the meteorite would have been really fast and ferocious. So picture yourself standing on an island 3.2 billion years ago. So back then, Earth would have been an ocean world with only a few volcanic islands and continents sticking out of the water column. So as you're standing there, right, you would see this splash of light approaching you, and next you'd be hit by a big pressure wave from the impact itself. Then as you're standing there, you would feel an enormous earthquake triggered by the impact. And at the same time,
you know, the skies would start to darken and to heat up. So that means the actual impactor and sedimentary rocks and, you know, the crust would actually be vaporized. So you form a rock vapor cloud that's going to expand into the atmosphere at incredibly fast speed. So this would make things really dark. And at the same time, the atmosphere will start heating up. And then probably what's going to actually kill you is the tsunami wave. So because the Earth back then was an ocean world, the impact really likely hit the ocean. And with that, it would displace the entire water column, initiating a huge tsunami that had the ability to sweep across the entire globe. And it would rip up the seafloor and really inundate coastlines. Afterwards, the atmosphere would still continue to heat up and it would get darker and darker. And actually, the temperatures would reach so hot that the oceans would have started boiling.
So you've painted a wonderful and enthralling picture of just how devastating this impact would have been. But the flip side of this is that out of that devastation sprang a whole new sort of creative opportunity for life.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this was really quite a surprise in our research. So what we see is two things. So firstly, we see a spike in phosphorus with the impact event. And so the impactor was a carbonaceous chondrite, and carbonaceous chondrites actually contain a lot of phosphorus. And the oceans back then were really starved in nutrients. So with the impact, you put hundreds of gigatons of phosphorus into the environment, and that's really important to life. On the other side, by the tsunami just sweeping across the globe, it mixed a lot of nutrient and iron-rich deep waters towards the surface where a lot of life was present. And iron is a really important element for our metabolism, so it provides cells energy. So we actually think that while in the short term, the consequences of the impact were certainly disastrous for life, actually there were transient benefits for life where life was actually able to flourish in the aftermath of the impact.
Tell me how you managed to make this discovery.
So there's this area in South Africa where exceptionally old rocks are preserved. And this is really quite rare that we have rocks this old that are that well preserved. And people had already found evidence for these giant meteorite impacts in those rocks. So we went into the field. We did a few years of field work, really collecting big amounts of samples and really studying the rocks in great detail.
It is an astonishing thing that you have discovered. I guess also it is a reminder of how much we have yet to discover about how life developed on Earth.
When we go further back in Earth history, we lose the rock record. So there's very few old rocks preserved. So, you know, the early evolution of life is a big mystery. But while a lot of things are controversial, we know for sure that meteorite impacts were a lot more frequent during the early Earth and that those must have affected the early evolution of life. So my study is really one of the first studies where we go into the rock record to understand how these impacts affected life.
An astonishing discovery. Nadia Drabon, assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour, and a wonderful story to bring you from the southwest of England now. 5 years ago, a group of friends bought some metal detectors and headed off to Somerset, and amazingly, they found treasure. Even more amazingly, it wasn't just one ancient coin, but more than 2,500. Became known as the Chew Valley Hoard. It's been announced today that it's been bought for the nation and at a value of £4.3 million, $5.5 million, making it the highest valued treasure ever found in England. Adam Staples is the man who found the first coin that wet weekend in 2019. Adam, welcome to NewsHour. And can you relive the moment for me?
Hi, good afternoon. We were in Somerset on holiday, as you say, and it was actually my friend who dug the first coin up. He shouted me over. He said, I found a silver coin, and I went over, had a look at it, and I was able to identify it as a penny of William the Conqueror, a very rare coin. And after a few minutes of looking at the coin and taking photos, we started to walk away and got signals immediately under our feet next to where the first coin was found. And yeah, it just led to more and more coins.
I mean, yes, beep, 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 beep. And these were coins from 1,000 years ago. I mean, the fact that you were able to identify this as a coin of William from the era of William the Conqueror is just amazing in itself. But I mean, you must have been simply staggered by the size of the hoard.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we didn't know how many coins were there originally. We weren't counting them as we dug them up, and we kept them all preserved in lumps of soil ready for the archaeologists to come and analyze them. And we only counted them a few days later, and we were staggered to find there were, I think there were 2,480 something from that first day.
Good grief. And am I right in saying that this was a fairly new venture for you?
No, I've been metal detecting for about 30 years.
Oh, right.
But, my friends had recently purchased a brand new metal detector, a new type, and I was down there for the weekend showing them how to get on with it because it was the same as the one I had.
I see. So it was a new bit of kit, at least for your friends. You then took this off to the British Museum. Before that happened, you must have just thought... you knew that this was important, but I mean, you must have been slightly terrified about sort of having to look after this extraordinary hoard.
Absolutely terrified, yeah. After the field, we went immediately to the pub, where we all sat in the pub nursing a pint, looking out the window at the car that was full of a big bucket full of coins worth millions of pounds.
Trying to look as innocent and unconcerned as possible.
Trying to look as casual as possible, yeah.
Oh, well, listen...
So it was a relief to finally drop them off at the British Museum and get them into their custody.
Yes, well, and I'm sure an added bonus to find out just how much this treasure has been worth. Adam, it's a joy to have you on the programme, and many congratulations on the find that you and your friends made. That's Adam Staples, and one of the people involved in the finding of the highest value treasure ever turned up in England. This is the BBC World Service and live from London. This is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. A bit later in the programme, we'll be talking about Russian influence or attempted influence on international affairs on Full Proud Show. But before that, a story about allegations of hidden Russian influence operations. It's to do with the former Soviet Republic of Moldova's referendum on closer ties with the European Union. It was a vote which was just won by the government, with a very narrow majority of voters in favour of joining the European Union. The allegation is that Russia interfered with the campaign and then with the vote. No journalist has done more to investigate those allegations than Mariuta Nishtor. She went undercover for 3 months for her newspaper, Zierold Garda. She spoke to me from the capital, Chisinau, first about the man at the centre of this alleged scheme, Ilan Shaw, a Moscow-based businessman who's been convicted in Moldova of money laundering and embezzlement.
Ilan Shaw is a criminal convicted to 50 years in prison for the theft of the billion in Moldova, the biggest theft in the history of the Republic of Moldova. And now he is heading in Moscow. Moscow want to disturb our...
Your vote, your referendum?
Yes. Our European partners, they want that referendum be not valid and people vote how Moscow said.
We know that there is opposition from Russia for Moldova to head in a more EU direction. What made you think that actually it might go beyond that, that actually there was the possibility of a network, a money for influence network that you wanted to investigate?
I infiltrated the network coordinated by Ilan Shaw, and I observed that for the money they receive, people are forced to protest, share complaint with disinformation, and vote as dictated to them from Moscow. I showed how the citizens of the Republic of Moldova are being paid with money from Moscow from January until now. The money was transferred through a bank account, a Russian bank. I observed that Russia consolidated this Shaw's network, and Russia wanted that our president, our government, our parliament pro-Russian.
So in the course of this 3 months, it wasn't just about the vote that happened over the weekend. What you're saying is that people were being paid to do things like go on demonstrations, go on protests.
Yes. They said who is the candidate before the elections, but in the 3-month period, I was in the network. They said we will vote no for the European Union accession.
You talked about in your investigation that people were getting, in quotes, instructions from Moscow. How certain were you that all this could be traced back to Ilan Shor in Moscow?
The money was transferred to the Maltrofa bank account of the bank in Russia, Transfesbank. It's a bank who have international sanction. Also, every day, I was getting calls from Moscow and they said me how I need to do. They said, Ilan Shor said that you need to do that, to do this. Ilan Shor every day send us a message, propagandistic message.
From what I've been reading, Ilan Shor is, despite his conviction and despite the questions that have been asked about his work out of Moscow and the way he's been trying to influence recent political campaigns, he's still very popular. Why do you think that is?
The reason is that Ilan Shor pays for his popularity. Ilan Shor is not popular for people who are critical thinking.
Mariutu, it's not just about the referendum for the European Union. There's also the runoff vote for the presidency that's about to happen. And there are also some very important parliamentary elections next year. How much influence do you think Ilan Shor could still have on those votes?
I think Ilan Shor will have influence as long as he has money from Moscow. When the money runs out, it will no longer have influence because people who are in Ilan Shor's network are poor and they want only money.
And that was the journalist who's been at the heart of those investigations, Mariota Zitor, speaking to me from Chisinau. And as you heard, what she had to say put Ilan Shor, the emigre Moldovan businessman and convicted criminal now living in Moscow, at the centre of this alleged pro-Russian vote-buying and vote-influencing scheme. So what's his response to those allegations?
First, it's full liar position of government. Why? First of all, government take money from government, from the state, and they do full promotion of European Union on money from the taxes. This is the first. Second, the organization like Konrad Adenauer Foundation, like Soros Foundation, they put a lot of money on this campaign and for the promotion of European Union. Third issue. Yes, my position fully understand from my side and from my people that we not support join European Union by Moldova. Second, that a lot of party who is agree with my position, government don't allow them to be participating in this referendum by the law and to tell their position to the people. Second issue, yes, I am the member of Eurasia Organization Foundation. It's something the same like Soros Foundation, like Konrad Adenauer, we do a lot of same job. Yes, it's true. We take people for the job. We have a full contract with them, contract by the law. We give to people money for paid taxes from this money what they received from us. The contract is about that they do promotion of our position. Their job is to tell people, to explain them why we are fully against European Union, why we need to do this. Because for last year, government closed 15 oppositional channels in Republic of Moldova. Today, if you will open your TV in Moldova, you can see only pro-government TV station. That's all. You have only one position. It's not normal. It's not democratic. For last 2 weeks was more than 140 raids searched by police in last 2 weeks before the election, and also not democratic.
It's one thing to fund a campaign from abroad, and you're saying, look, the people who were in favour of joining the European Union, they got money from outside lobby groups as well. But the investigations that have been done into your network have shown that people have been paid to come on demonstrations, on protests, and far more seriously, that people have been given money to vote in a certain way. That is something different, isn't it?
Okay, I explain you. First, we never give money people to vote for us, and we never give people... First, what you say, sorry, for vote, and first you say...
For protests, so people were being
for
paid...
We never give money. The question that no one normal people in Moldova not believe to prosecutor office of Moldova and to police, because they are fully under the government, they are not independent. They are fully not independent. It was a lot of examples when prosecutor office and police do all against the law. That's why we not believe, not prosecutor office, not police today, unfortunately.
You say people don't believe the prosecutor's office. I mean, why should people, to be blunt, believe you, given that you have a conviction for an absolutely massive banking fraud?
I explain you, in this conviction, nobody also not believe. You see what result I have in Moldova and how people believe me. Not no one believe in this conviction because all people know that this is a political prosecution. Second, we know very good that in the first tour that Maya Sandu used the power of the state to have this result. And even with this, she really have bad result because they have in country only 36%. Interesting how good outside of the country, because we know that was massive falsification in European Union in Embassy of Moldova. We have a lot of photo, video materials, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the evening when voting station was empty. And in this, even in the second Central Election Commission give us information that very, very massive voting now, and even in this voting section.
You talked about your support for Alexander Stoyanoglo, the man who came second in the presidential election. He now goes into a runoff with the current president, who is the pro-European Union candidate. Mr. Stoyanoglo, from what I understand, he has said that he is in agreement with the idea of joining the European Union in principle for Moldova. So can you explain to me why you think he is the right man, given that you're so against the European Union?
I don't tell that I support Alexander Stoyanoglo first. I even don't say my position in second tour. Why? Because I need to speak with my team, with my people. We will do this in a few days. We will discuss our position in second tour. Yes, we gained position of European Union, and we will think what to do. It will be our target to understand our position in second tour in a few days.
But, I mean, presumably you don't want President Sandu to get back in.
I don't want President Sandu at all, yes, in principle. But what we will do in second tour, we will think, because we have other option also.
Right. I mean, you're saying this all from... I mean, you're currently in Moscow, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in Moscow.
I mean, does it sound right to you that you're talking about how you can influence, I mean, so openly talking about how you can influence the next vote inside Moldova? You don't hear people in other foreign capitals talking about, you know, what they can do to change the result of an election in another country in such an open way.
Of course, as they speak, Mr. Macron give fully support to Maya Sandu and help her with money from budget to France. Von der Leyen was in Moldova and speak stupid things that she will give 3 billion euro to Moldova, what has never happened, and she knows this, to support Maya Sandu. From Washington, a lot of people support Maya Sandu openly and give money. We understand each other. But the problem is that money from me, it's black money, but the money from them, it's white money. It's because today we have such world when all what is go from European Union in the United States is good, all what go from Russia, it's bad.
And
it's
just to be clear, you say all that comes from Russia. Is this money your money, or is it money that you are being given to spend?
It's my money. It's my money. It's money of people who do donation in Eurasia organization. Yes, I have money, and it's not big secret.
Do you have any contacts with the Kremlin?
No, of course no. I'm a person who is do business here, and I live here. Here live my family. I do Moldavian politics. And of course, I have no official contacts about Moldova.
Right. No official contacts. Unofficial contacts?
All we have different friends. It's normal. It's our life.
And that was Ilan Shaw. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London with me, Tim Franks. And back to Russia's sway on events beyond its borders. Now, whisper it quietly, but sometimes international summits can be a bit of a bore. Photo ops and communiques and not much else. And yet, today's summit of the BRICS countries, plus others, in other words, emerging economies, big and smaller, does carry a certain symbolic weight, at the very least, because it is being hosted in Russia by Vladimir Putin, a man the West wants to portray as a pariah. Steve Rosenberg is our Russia editor and is at the summit venue in Kazan. Steve, what do you think the message is that Vladimir Putin wants to impart?
Hello, Tim. I think the main message is that you thought Russia was isolated. We're not at all. I'm in the big BRICS press centre right now, and there are several giant video screens, and for the last few hours they've been transmitting on these screens meeting after meeting, Vladimir Putin meeting world leaders as they fly into Kazan for the BRICS summit. And this is exactly the optics he wants to transmit to the world, that despite Western efforts to declare Mr. Putin a pariah because of his invasion of Ukraine, despite Western efforts to isolate Russia, there are still plenty of world leaders ready to sit down at the table and do business with him. More than 20 heads of state are expected in Kazan this week, delegations from 36 countries. And you can be sure that Vladimir Putin will make the most of that over the next few days.
Yeah. And, I mean, do you get a sense, I know it's terribly difficult sometimes at sort of at various stages of remove at these summits, but do you get a sense that the delegations that are flying in are sort of enthusiastically buying into the broad notion that, look, this is no longer a sort of West-dominated world?
It's early days yet for this summit. I think to an extent, yes. I think the one thing that unites the nine members of BRICS and also the couple of other dozen that are going to be here and want to have closer ties with BRICS is that they feel that something has to be changed in terms of the global economy and the dominance that so-called advanced Western economies have. So that brings them together. Having said that, there's a lot that divides the BRICS members. There are lots of disagreements, there are lots of differences of opinion, even animosity, if you look at the relationship between two of the biggest BRICS members, India and China. They have a very checkered relationship. Mm. Egypt and Ethiopia, two of the newest BRICS members, they have a very tense relationship too. Iran, Saudi Arabia, a difficult relationship. And on the one hand, you've got Russia, which is fueled by anti-Western sentiment, and basically, I think, sees BRICS as a tool to completely reshape the global order. On the other hand, you have India, also a BRICS member, but a country which is determined to retain good political and economic relationships with the West. So all kinds of differences, and I think that will make it difficult, or has in the past made it difficult, for BRICS to come to any sort of meaningful agreements.
Yeah, and just briefly, Steve, any sort of attempt by the Russians here to sort of go big and solid and sort of come up with an alternative to the sort of to the dollar, a new BRICS payment system, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that is one thing to look out for this week. The Kremlin is pushing the idea of a new cross-border payments system that would not depend on the dollar. Basically, Moscow wants to reduce the influence the dollar has in the global economy to ease the effects of sanctions. You know, Western sanctions have had an effect, have made it difficult for Russia to trade and to pay for things. So look for that. Also this week, look for comments on the war in Ukraine and also the war in the Middle East. There could be interesting announcements about that this week too.
Steve Rosenberg at the BRICS summit in Kazan. Thank you very much. And as Steve was saying, it's not clear just how much links some of the major BRICS countries, none bigger, of course, than China and India. But there has, it seems, been progress on one long-running dispute between the two countries. It's over their extended shared Himalayan border, a dispute which stretches back decades and has on occasion turned deadly. Mickey Bristow is our Asia regional editor.
apparently it's about a series of areas in Ladakh, which is an area of India which borders China. And essentially it's about how the two militaries from each side conduct patrols in that area. But there have been conflict in the past there, particularly 4 years ago in this particular region. There was a battle, in fact, between soldiers from both sides, quite a medieval battle using clubs and sticks. And 20 Indian soldiers died, 4 Chinese soldiers died. And so it's essentially this agreement is to try and stop that kind of incident taking place, just that both sides can patrol without coming into conflict with each other.
From what I remember from the last battles, they were sort of building at some pace either side of the border as well. They were trying to sort of establish de facto control.
Yeah, you're hinting there at the sort of like temporary nature of this agreement, and I think that's absolutely correct. Essentially, it's just about how these militaries patrol what is a temporary border. There's no indication at all that this agreement tries to resolve a decades-old dispute about this bit of the border and other bits of the border. You know, it's several thousand miles long, and there are conflict points at other places as well. And so this agreement doesn't touch that at all. You also mentioned there about the build-up of forces on either side. That's true. India's been building a road to Ladakh so it can get its forces there quicker. China's been doing the same on the other side. Both have been sort of like rushing to establish their own positions before any agreement like this came into practice, just so that they had a better position to bargain any agreement. So I think this is certainly just a temporary agreement, and it could collapse at any moment, and it doesn't resolve the long-running disagreement about exactly where the border is.
Are there any efforts internationally to try and resolve this? I mean, is there a process?
Not really. It's merely taking place between India and China over the last few years since that big fight I just told you about in 2020 in Ladakh. The militaries from the two sides have had several dozen meetings where they've kind of got together, tried to thrash out a way that they could both patrol their sides of the border without coming into conflict. In many, many of these meetings, and thus far they hadn't reached an agreement. Perhaps the only thing internationally you could say is that because both leaders of China and India are in Russia at the moment at the summit for the BRICS nations, perhaps that spurred some kind of or given some kind of impetus to come to agreement. So perhaps Narendra Modi and Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, can meet at this conference. So perhaps there has been some, if not external pressure or mechanism, some kind of pressure from the international events which have forced this deal through. But certainly there's no real mechanism and no, as I said, indication that this is anything other than a temporary arrangement.
And that was our Asia regional editor, Mickey Bristow, bringing this edition of NewsHour to a close. From me, Tim Franks, and the team here in London, thanks for listening.